Welcome again to another episode of Left Turn Canada. I'm Andy Burkowski. Christo Avalise here to examine all of the Canadian issues from a leftist perspective. And I think, Christo, this week might be our first since the run of the show where I don't think we're going to talk about COVID or Doug Ford.
Well, at least not as the main segment.
I think we might not even say it. I'm gonna watch.
I'm pretty sure we won't talk about four. We might have to talk about COVID a little bit. We'll get into that. We'll talk a bit about COVID.
Yeah, Christo's hinting there. We got a lot to talk about. There are crises going on around the world, but just some breaking news today of the day of recording. It was announced that Greyhound is shutting down its routes across Canada through different provinces and locally. And you know, this on its face may not seem like a big deal, but Christo, this is huge when talking about the essential services like busing and transportation that can fall so easily by the ups and downs of capitalism that we have nothing that really protects that. Like, for so many communities, I think this is going to be a huge deal.
Oh, 100%. I mean, look, the reality is that a lot of intercity passenger travel, whether we're talking rail or bus, has taken a hit over the past few years and indeed decades. So this is not a new phenomenon. But I mean, this is, you know, Greyhound has kind of constantly been downsizing for the past few years. But this is, you know, finally a full shutdown Canada wide. It really is something that I don't think a lot of people were expecting. And it's a big deal because whether we're talking about Greyhound or whether we talked about basically the dismantling of the public bus system in Saskatchewan by the right-wing Sask party a couple years ago, these bus services are essential to link communities. Marginalized people depend on them. Elderly people depend on them. Just people who, for whatever reason, don't drive depend on them. And they're often the only way to get from a smaller town, a smaller city, to, you know, the local metropolis, right? Whether it's just for shopping, for healthcare, to travel in turn to another city by getting on a plane or whatever, losing this essential bus service is a big deal. And it really does show that fundamentally, the market cannot be depended upon to provide essential services because people need these buses and they're not being provided. And like, that's a simple failure of the supposed equilibrium, the elegant dance of supply and demand. Now, I think the solution should be, and we could talk more about this as this develops. This isn't the main topic of the episode, but I think the solution should be to integrate a national bus program into Via Rail. The Via Rail used to, at least on a limited basis, run buses and use bus service to link to smaller communities where there was no rail to bring people to rail hubs and then put them on trains. And there's no reason why that couldn't be part of a Via Rail system in addition to expanded rail travel. So there's no reason why your Via Rail couldn't pick up some of this slack. And the federal government should certainly look into that.
Are you worried, Christo? Like, that seems like the reasonable, you know, big government needs to take care of its citizens alternative. I saw jokes about this on Twitter, but I wouldn't put past a lot of the capitalists that run this country. What if it was outsourced to, you know, tech firms like Uber or the like, of trying to have these alternative services now because there is a market that's open? You know, the market deemed that Greyhound is no longer viable. Your solution is one that actually reinvigorates and help Canadians. If you know, the government allowed the market to destroy this service, who's to say that they wouldn't allow this same, you know, dubious market system to put something in place like Uber or something like that, that is so privatized and so damaging? Like, I know people were saying it as a joke, but I don't know. I think something like that could be in the works.
I mean, I think, well, look, to be clear, there are, in some places that don't have reliable public transit, there are, you know, van companies and companies that do offer these things. There are companies that, you know, run small to medium-sized vans that will take people from communities outside the GTA right to Pearson. And like, that's the business model. You can charter a van, put your family in it, and get a drive to Pearson, not have to worry about parking your car there, or not have to worry about if you don't drive, and then get on your plane to wherever the heck you're going, right? Mm-hmm. So I have no doubt that some of these companies will fill those roles. Now, the question is, will it service the people that actually need it as an essential service, right?
Yeah.
There's no doubt that, you know, in some of these places, there will be companies that fill these roles, but there is something to be said for the fact that, you know, especially the routes that Greyhound abandoned before ultimate shutdown, I mean, they abandoned them because at least under their model, they couldn't be profitable. So it's a mixture of, is it actually profitable? And if it is profitable, who has enough money to make it profitable, right? Yeah. What kind of person can pay the higher per mileage cost? Because you lose efficiency when you don't have a 70-person bus. Instead, you're piling people into a 12-person van. And does it leave out the poor people, you know, people on fixed incomes, maybe indigenous people who don't have a lot of means? Like, that's the issue here, right? That's the issue. In addition to the fact that at a time when we really do need to be investing in green infrastructure, and public transit is green infrastructure, we seem to be going backwards when the new solution is not one bus for 70 people, but five vans for 40 people, right?
It does seem insane and so wrongheaded. And, you know, the people that you mentioned that have fallen through the cracks with this have in many cases already fallen through the cracks. And I think it's not controversial or radical to say that public transportation shouldn't have to yield a profit to be valuable. There is value in the service it provides. And like, this seems like a very common refrain whenever we're talking about how the government tries to provide us with the basic things we need. But this planet is dying. There's big country out in a lot of these areas. We need reliable alternatives. Yeah. And we just lost one, you know, today that has been the staple for a really long time. The likelihood of something coming in its place that would be the ideal, you know, is necessary. How likely would something like that happen? You're the Via Rail idea that you first introduced, you know, what do you think? Is that, who could get political purchase on that sort of push at this point in time?
I mean, if Justin Trudeau said we're going to do it, it would happen, because Jagmeet Singh would say yes. The Bloc might say yes as well. The Greens would probably say yes, and it would get done. But I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, you might see some more provincial investment, because again, if it's through Via Rail, one, it's interprovincial travel, so it's clearly under federal jurisdiction. But also, two, it is Via Rail's already a federally owned, it's owned by the federal government. So it's clearly something the federal government can do. The question will be, will you see provincial solutions? That is a potential, but for the most part, it hasn't happened. Like when growing up in the Maritimes, when the Maritimes lost much of its bus service, it wasn't necessarily replaced by, you know, a publicly owned New Brunswick bus company or something like that.
Yeah.
So I'm skeptical, honestly, but I do think that this is an opportunity perhaps for Singh and the NDP, hint, hint, maybe if Jagmeet's listening to this right now while he's biking, you know, to maybe make this one of the platform pieces to say that we want to find a way, both as a matter of connecting communities, help ensuring marginalized people get are not, like, you know, sort of disconnected from everybody else.
Yeah.
And also, as a matter of providing public services and building green infrastructure, we want Via Rail not only to expand its rail service, but to integrate at least in some part some bus service to link communities.
And, you know, once again, we're on that knife's edge of looking at the hopeful alternative that could deal with a lot of the problems that this planet faces in 2021 versus returning to even more archaic, and barbaric ways of dealing with these practices.
Well, let's be clear on this one, on this kind of issue. We have to be clear, right? Because fundamentally, like, this is one of those issues we've taken a step back on.
Yeah.
Google available rail service 50 years ago, 60 years ago, and you will see that whether it was internal to cities or between cities, public transit was far more prevalent, right? In North America. Now, we're not just talking Europe here where they have tons of public. In North America, public transit was prevalent. But with the after the Second World War and at an accelerating pace, the car became king.
Yeah.
Like, they're, you know, before, you know, Doug Ford. Oh, geez, we mentioned him.
Oh,
you know
how
the
Christo.
Ford family, you know, the Ford family loves to talk about the war on the car.
Yeah.
But I mean, the war was already won by the car in many ways, right? Mm. Like, they tore up streetcars. They tore up railways that linked very small towns and traveled much more frequently between big cities than they currently do. And so when we talk about, like, oh, barbarism and archaicness, I mean, this is one of the few things that if, like, or that, you know, maybe they did better back in the old days, that more people took public transit, including fairly well-off people. But, you know, we live in the era of the car still, and a lot of the green solutions, frankly, still revolve around, well, everyone should have electric cars, but that still doesn't solve the matter that electric cars are still carbon-intensive to build. And many of the materials in those cars are you know, have negative environmental outcomes to extract from the environment.
And human outcomes of, like, just pure desolation in lithium mines and, you know, pure swaths of places like the half the size of Texas being, you know, completely destroyed.
Exactly. So beyond that, we really do have to look at not just green transit, but green mass transit. And we're moving in the wrong direction in Canada.
Yeah, I don't know if you got a chance to see any of the clips or even the show itself from last week, but I don't want someone who has the mind of Elon Musk to be responsible for saving our planet through green initiatives, because based on, you know, his public persona and what we saw him on SNL last week, like, this is, we're definitely heading in the wrong direction. So we're going to, you know, keep looking at that story. We'll see what happens. They're always hopeful. The biggest story of the week, the most important thing, really, that is happening right now on a global scale for us, Western audiences, looking into the events of the world, is the crisis that's happening in Palestine and Israel right now. Like, it is so vitally important. People are dying in what can be described as, you know, something akin to an ethnic cleansing of what these Israeli colonial settlers are doing to people that are living in these homes that they now claim they have no right to, you know, being ripped out of your bed, as we've seen in these videos, by some pompous fat Zionist who, like you noted, Christo, many of which have that North American accent, that are coming to Israel and these regions in the Holy Land to fulfill these Zionist ideals, and knowing that a home that you've lived in, you can't protect, because if you raise your hand, some insane 23-year-old is gonna, you know, kill your children. Like, it's not uncommon in that region. So I could not begin to imagine what it's like with this going crisis
Right off the top, we're gonna try to be careful with our language, but even in our pre-chat, we're guilty of this too. Yeah. I mean, like, Andy, and like, I think Andy, when we started talking about it, Andy basically said, "Oh, well, we're gonna talk about the clash." It's not a clash. It's not a battle. It's a massacre. Mm-hmm. Like, Palestinians are being massacred. And yes, I understand that every once in a while, an Israeli citizen is affected, and that's true. But there is a total, unequivocal, unimaginable asymmetry of power and of violence and of death and of given all that, of responsibility.
Yeah.
Right. And like, a lot of people have made this very clear, like, look, if the only Israel can stop this, I mean, as a global community, we can put pressure on Israel, but like, barring that, like, in this dispute, only Israel can stop it. If Hamas or just individual people just stop doing anything to Israel right now, Israel would continue to steal their shit and there wouldn't be Palestinians in 20, 30, 40 years. And that's the goal of at least a significant portion of, like, the Israeli ruling class, right?
And, like, that's ethnic cleansing. But, like, that needs to be said. Like, that
it
is.
It's genocide. It's genocide.
Absolutely genocide.
It's genocide.
It is, and it is supported by massive amounts of Western audiences, politicians, the general public. And we're going to talk a little more about why that's happening. But just understanding that even despite being pressured by these sorts of forces, where you know that you can lose everything. I don't know if you saw that very compelling interviewee that was on CNN and a whole bunch of other networks that was talking about this genocide, Palestinian, that the next day was pulled out of his house by IDF forces for describing, you know, to the international community what is happening here. In these regions, we have open air prisons. You know, 97% of the drinking water isn't potable. It's completely controlled by Israeli forces that, like you said, are trying to culturally and militarily get rid of a certain ethnic class. And normally, when this happens in other parts of the world with other sorts of people, there is an outcry by the Western community. Like, that is something that, at least publicly, we've been lauded for as Canadians and even to a lesser extent Americans. But we found out that is not the case, Christo. So I want to talk to you first about Canada's response to this genocide that's happening, and you know, what are some of the politicians of note saying?
So basically, Andy, I did some research into this. I wrote a piece for Canadian Dimension, a great source. Maybe we'll put a link in the show notes, where we talked a bit about how Canada's political class, unsurprisingly, like our media class, vacillates between, on the one hand, just taking Israel's side, no matter how much evil they do, right? Or doing a kind of like, oh, it's complicated. Oh, there's both sides need to stop. Oh, it's so tragic what's happening. If only Israel and Palestine would realize they have common interests, maybe we could move forward on a basis of peace. And so basically, Mark Garneau, he's the foreign affairs minister of the Trudeau Liberal government, came out and sort of did that. His statement wasn't the worst. In fact, out of the non-NDP statements, it was probably the best, and the bar is very low. Mm-hmm. He acknowledged the specific atrocities happening, the theft of communities. He also acknowledged the attacks on the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is not just any regular mosque, as bad as it would be to see Israelis destroy a sacred place of worship for Muslims during Ramadan. Specifically on one of the holier nights, Al-Aqsa Mosque outside of Mecca and Medina is perhaps the holiest site in all of Islam, right? Mm-hmm. So it is, it's like you, our friend Matthew Green said, like, not like to, and really made it vivid. It's like if you were seeing flashbang grenades tossed into the Vatican.
Yeah, trying to firebomb
the Vatican, one of the holiest sites of Christianity, certainly right up there, obviously, especially for Catholics, but probably for Christians more broadly, given the symbolism. Mm-hmm. It's an incredibly important site. And so Mark Garneau acknowledged that, but made it very clear. He made it very clear that, this is Canada and Israel are friends. All sides must de-escalate. No unilateral actions must be taken. And clearly it's a both sides thing. It's a little bit better than you might expect, but only a tiny bit.
Did he invoke, by the way, the, you know, Israel has a right to maintain its autonomy and security? I know there's a lot of that going around by Western forces.
Not explicitly necessarily in this statement. I mean, this it's a short statement. I'm sure the Liberal government will 100% do that. We saw Joe Biden do that. Mm-hmm. I know we've been praising Joe Biden relative to Trudeau, but on this, they are both, I think, roughly equally shitty. It's part of the broad consensus. Now, Elizabeth May, the former Green Party leader, retweeted Mark Garneau and sort of made it even worse than Garneau did when she said, "I think we should strengthen our condemnation of treatment of Palestinians. As you say, both sides must step back." So she acknowledges that we have to talk about being stronger on critiquing the treatment of Palestinians. But again, both sides must step back. Well, no. One, it's an asymmetry of power. And two, I mean, look, maybe this is controversial, but I sort of think that the Palestinians have a right to defend their goddamn communities and way of life and sacred holy sites. And like, look, you don't condemn every individual action taken in Palestine, but like, I kind of think they're at least partially justified, right?
No, there's, so there was a comment from that individual I mentioned earlier who was ripped out of his home, that their assessment is that more people have died from the Israeli airstrikes in the last week than there are active members of Hamas. So they've
That wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah,
that
so would not surprise me. And I just, you know, just want a quick interjection here. Like, you see the images of little kids throwing rocks at IDF tanks. And you get this sense of, like, how disillusioned do you and I feel against, you know, the weight of what's happening in our country and many others, but don't feel strong enough to do anything about it. Now, imagine, like, this strength and just vigor, like determination of so many of these Palestinians to keep fighting when the deck is so stacked against them. It's a means of survival. And the fact that anyone would try to liken this to both sides when you see the actual people that are involved in this atrocity, it's difficult not to get really, really angry about it.
100%. And so it gets even worse because if you read the Green Party's, because, you know, Liz May, maybe as a shock to Liz May, is no longer the leader of the Green Party of Canada. But if you read their statement, they basically, it's a short statement again, they basically write that, you know, this is awful, but they use the term clash. All sides need to de-escalate, but they don't mention the asymmetry of violence, which even the liberals sort of hint at.
Yeah.
And they don't mention that there's specific attacks on Palestinians, their homes, and their sacred sites. Mm-hmm. Right? But of course, and I don't think this is a surprise, the conservatives had the worst statement where they say, we're a friend of Israel, we condemn Hamas, we condemn the rocket attacks on Israel. And they do call for a de-escalation in a general sense, but make it very clear, as you sort of hinted, that Israel, as the victim of a terrorist attack, essentially, has a right to defend itself, which, again, is very similar to Biden. So in many ways, Biden and O'Toole are united in their rhetoric on this one. But what was crucial was the NDP took a bit of a different stand. Mm-hmm. We talked about this a couple weeks ago when the convention was on. Right after the convention, Andy and I were very lucky to have guests.
Genevieve Nevin and Amy Kishchak on the Palestine resolution.
And they were a part of a team. It wasn't just them, but they were part of a team, and they spearheaded the effort to bring a resolution forward which said that the NDP would call upon the federal government, and if we formed power, would implement a policy that, one, barred weapon sales to Israel until there was justice for Palestinians, and would effectively cease, doing business with Israeli companies and trade if it was happening within illegal Israeli settlements. And this is one of the things happening here. You have settlers just going into territory of Palestinians and stealing their shit, right? Mm-hmm. Now, Israel will say, oh, it's actually just a series of private land disputes, but that's bullshit, and I'm not even going to dignify that. People are going in and just stealing people's, like, properties.
We've
right?
seen it. Like, it's very public in this day and age that you see people saying it. You see a lot of these Zionists saying that full-throated. Like, this is their right to this land. So this idea that it's not unified under a ideology in some way is just, like, that's not what the people are saying on the ground on either side of that. So I can't imagine. But, what did Jagmeet say? I got to know.
So basically, the party adopted that policy, and some people were concerned because, as with any party, you adopt a policy and it doesn't really go anywhere. But Singh, to his credit, you know, kept his word. Mm-hmm. Singh, to his credit, came in and both in a press conference and in Parliament at a question period, demanded that Canada stop selling weapons to Israel, that effectively were trying to, on the one hand, acknowledge this as a quote unquote both sides thing when there's a clear asymmetry of power and we're arming one side to kill the other side, right? And so at the very least, the literal least we can do is stop arming Israel as it commits genocide against the Palestinians. And Singh said that. And also it should be noted that when NDPers like Singh and foreign affairs critic Jack Harris spoke, they did not both sides it. Here's what Jack Harris said. He's an MP from St. John's, Newfoundland, and he's the party's foreign affairs critic. He said, escalating violence in East Jerusalem as a result of the ongoing illegal occupation is deeply troubling. The demolitions, forced removal of Palestinians from their homes, and blocking access to popular gathering spots must end. Israel needs to put a stop to the illegal evictions and de-escalate, and Canada must increase efforts to seek a peaceful resolution to the ongoing conflict. And I believe, Andy, we have a clip of Singh calling out Justin Trudeau in question period.
Let's play that right now.
Yeah.
Violence in East Jerusalem is deeply disturbing. Demolitions, forcefully removing Palestinians from their homes, and blocking access to important gathering spots are all violations of human rights and international laws. Instead of taking action to stop or to deal with the long-standing illegal occupations, this prime minister is effectively supporting the status quo and going as far as to sell weapons to Israel. By arming one side of the conflict, it is undermining the peace process and it is supporting the illegal occupation. So will the prime minister commit to stopping the sale of arms to Israel while they are violating international human rights?
Right, Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, we are following the situation with grave concern. We call on all parties to end the violence, de-escalate tensions, protect civilians, and uphold international law.
And so what you can hear there is one, Singh obviously makes the right point. Trudeau, of course, is a spineless coward as per usual. He basically says, we're monitoring this very closely. We want peace and security for everyone. But again, makes it very clear that, Canada is a friend of Israel and sort of emphasizes Israel's basic right and blah, 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 blah. I'm not going to spend time on Justin Trudeau's jellyfish of an answer. Mm-hmm. But the point is, this is significant. Like, look, there's a lot more the NDP could do. The NDP could support more sanctions on Israel. The NDP could be stronger with its language. The NDP could have done all this without having to have Amy and Genevieve and hundreds of others fight for this, but they did it. And this is important, right? They're the only major party in Canada that took a statement that didn't both sides the issue. And that's actually calling for some consequences for Israel. And again, I don't think the NDP is saying that there's literally nothing being done wrong ever in Palestine. What they are saying is clearly only one side. And we talked, like I said earlier, only one side can stop this. It has to be Israel. Israel can stop this. If Israel stopped this right now, there could be peace between Israel and Palestine immediately. Immediately, there would be effective peace. Only Israel can do that. And so we have to ask ourselves, how do we bring that about? And frankly, and this is my view, and that Israel is very much analogous to pre-Mandela, civil liberties South Africa. It's very much like the apartheid state of South Africa. Now, there are key differences. There are historic differences. There are practical differences. All of these things. But in effect, you have a system where you have a group of people that have full rights, full citizenship, have a significantly higher standard of living, of education, of mobility, and then you have another group of people by virtue of race and other factors that are dehumanized, do not have basic rights. Like, look, I know we said we weren't going to talk about Ford or vaccines here. We already talked about Ford, but like vaccines are a key factor here.
Yeah.
If you look at health outcomes and in the two countries, they're significant, but early on in the COVID vaccination rush, I'm sure we all saw that Israel was doing great. Like, Israel was doing great at vaccinating people, far and away the best country in the world at it. But that hid the fact that they weren't vaccinating Palestinians. And Israel currently right now is exporting vaccines, even though vaccination rates in Palestine are significantly lower. So they vaccinated the official quote unquote citizens of the Israeli state, most of whom are Israeli Jews, but not exclusively. There are Arab citizens. And the overwhelmingly Arab Muslim, you know, Palestinian population is suffering without the vaccines, in addition to everything else. So this is also a COVID story. When you see all of these big gatherings of Israelis all over Israel, being able to go out to restaurants and stuff. I mean, it's great to see, like, for those individual people, I'm very happy for them. But fundamentally, if you cross, you know, an arbitrary line, Palestinians are continuing to suffer from COVID, and Israel is doing sweet fuck all about it.
Yeah, well, it's like you said, it's worse than sweet fuck all. It is that same sort of apartheid.
Yeah, in some cases, they're blocking access. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're right. If they literally did nothing, it wouldn't be as bad. No, you're right. That's a good point.
For so many of these Arabs that live in these occupied areas where they're completely controlled by Israeli forces, you know, a lot of them don't even have access to their passports. There's different lineups in different areas if you are, you know, a Palestinian versus an Israeli to travel.
Like, yeah, it's
areas.
Apartheid, right? It
in,
is.
In
like,
the
right,
clearest
like,
sense, it's hard not to see this. And if this was applied to any other region, we would be, I think, very simply stating that it is apartheid. But because there is such a historical precedent for the, I would say, domination of one force over another, I think there is, it's affecting all of our language. Like we said before, it's affecting how
specifically
you and I,
too. Yeah, we have to say this here. Like this is settler colonialism.
Yes,
right?
But
like,
I wanted to say that too. I think it is move by the left in Canada too to say like, oh man, you think it's bad in Israel what's happened to Palestinians. Do you know what happened to, you know, native peoples here in Canada? Like, I don't know if there's a dude who is really pro-Palestinian in Canada but doesn't acknowledge, you know, the horrible things that our
colonial ancestors
did.
The point is though is that less about, cuz I'm not going to get into what's worst, Canada's genocide or Israel's genocide.
Yeah, I've heard that being thrown around a bit, and it's just
the point is though that like that settler colonial nations stick together, right? Yeah. One of the reasons why Canada, there's lots of reasons, right? But one of the reasons why I think Canada has always been reluctant to do anything in this scenario is that like Canada exists because of what you stealing land, kicking people out of where they live, denying people equal rights and denying people mobility. We literally did all this shit. In some cases, we continue to do it. I'm not necessarily saying it's as intensified as what's happening in Israel-Palestine, but the history is there. And so it's like for Canada, the U.S., Australia, a lot of these sorts of countries, it's like, man, we it's hard because people are going to be like, well, what about your own population? And I think that's why there's a lot of reluctance among a lot of the establishment. But like, you know, it's like, the famous Twitch streamer, Hassan, he did some good coverage on this. And he's basically like, look, this is what Canada and the United States did to indigenous people. It's just now it's 2021 and you're seeing it all in 4K, right? Like you're seeing it on TikTok. You're seeing it on Twitch. You're seeing it on YouTube. You're getting it on podcasts. And the mainstream media isn't quite so monolithic that alternative takes are breaking through. Although I should give credit, some sources, people like Mehdi Hassan on MSNBC. I know it's generally a pretty shitty network for the left. Look out, remember how they treated Bernie. Mm-hmm. But like credit to Mehdi Hassan, he's done a really good job within the bounds of corporate media of highlighting this issue. And so I think that's one encouraging thing here is that media is still on its bullshit, but like you're seeing a lot of big names do the right thing here.
There, it is amazing to see these dividing lines when it comes to the Canadian media's response, mainstream media, like we mentioned, response to this crisis. You talked about how politicians are responding, and Jagmeet really has one of the best lines, but it's still not even perfect as a position here. I think within just general mainstream media, it is far worse. You know, after the Human Rights Watch released their damning report on Israeli atrocities at the end of April, within 3 weeks, there was only throughout all of Canada two major outlets that covered it. One was the Canadian Press Wire Service that covers almost any basic story and packages it out so that other media firms can really easily use it. So that's like their service. And the other one was the Globe and Mail, who did an assessment of it and even had some questions about whether or not it was valid. CBC, Global News, The Star, nothing in the last 3 weeks. And then once this crisis hit, there's a great article here, I believe it's actually in Vice, that looked at the Canadian media's outlook on what's happening. Almost all major outlets are calling what's happening right now in Israel and Palestine a war. Nearly half of them had majority stories in which the mention of airstrikes was the subject, the lead, and the focus. And they said, I think it was less than 15% of these major outlets had stories that were solely covering the genocidal colonial practices of these Israeli Zionists into, you know, this region and trying to kick people out. It's mentioned sparingly in other stories, but having that as the clickable link or in the paper just wasn't happening in the last few weeks. And we look at even the opinion pieces that are usually pumped out to reflect Canadian ideals when something is happening, you know, around the world. It still has that all sidesism that we discussed. You know, they're talking to people who are Palestinians in, I think this is a CBC story, in Winnipeg about how horrible this is and, you know, what it means to have this particular mosque attacked, only to be followed by a Jewish official in a community leader saying that this is Hamas's fault and we can't consider and minimize the threats of Hamas. So, you know, as much as media is, like you said, there are some great stars there that are really pushing this.
And there's a factor in Canadian media too, where specifically, and look, neither of us are Jewish, right? Yeah. You know, like, so we should be careful, but I think there is definitely an effort to sort of marginalize any Jewish person that is critical in any way of Israel, either in general, aka they don't necessarily identify as a Zionist, or in this particular instance, or any particular flashpoint that we've seen in this crisis that, you know, this is the biggest one in a long time, obviously, but it's not the first. And you know, sadly, I don't think it'll be the last. You know, a lot of times people in these communities are ostracized by more conservative Jewish elements, or they are instantly dismissed as being a lunatic, fringe, self-hating Jew, what have you. And I think it's very important to note that in many ways in Canada, the leaders of this movement to finally have Canada stand for justice in Palestine, and also, you know, peace and security for Israelis, have been progressive Jews in Canada. And I think that's something the mainstream media, I think, knowing the power that that has, the rhetorical power of seeing Jewish people take that stand, they tend not to highlight it. Mm-hmm. You know, they tend not to highlight that. And so I think that's something we definitely have to acknowledge. Many of the leaders are from those communities. So you're right. They'll get a representation, quote unquote, of the Jewish community, but it's not always clear how representative that is of the Jewish community.
I can't imagine, we talked about before, the strength of having to fight against these forces, you know, feeling like you are at odds with the public representation, perhaps, of this community that you're a part of, and having to fight to further that message because you believe it's the right thing to do, is an incredibly difficult task that I don't think most people necessarily have the gumption or push to always do. Like, we're dealing with the extremes of people's ideological beliefs versus a real formal moral understanding of clarity, you know, they a real belief of what is the right thing to do here. So it is a huge task for many to go up against these forces. But the amazing thing is we're seeing it happen, and we're seeing these leaders do speak out. I wanted to pose this to you. Does it feel like this moment now, it's an ongoing crisis where these instances have happened again and again and again, do you feel like now there is more of a pro-Palestinian contingent in the media we consume, in the political rhetoric that we hear, than before? Is there something maybe to be hopeful publicly, or at least in the general consciousness, that things could change while recognizing that ultimately, you know, Israel can make this stop? But just in the general public's feeling of the culture around this, have you seen more of these popular sentiments coming up?
I mean, my instinct is yeah. Like I kind of think there definitely has been something of a turn. I think that people are more and more, I guess, cognizant of what Israel is doing, how the asymmetry of power is real, how there is predominantly in this situation a good guy and a bad guy, and it's really not all that complicated. I think you're seeing that more. I think you're seeing more and more people be comfortable speaking out on it. I think there's a reason why the NDP has done this. I think, one, it's a lot of pressure from activists, but two, I think that, you know, people are seeing the tides turn. And I think that I honestly believe that 30, 40 years from now, this is going to be seen potentially as South Africa, you know, South African apartheid. Mm-hmm. And the defenders of that system are going to be, you know, they're not always ostracized. There's plenty of people that defended South African apartheid who never really necessarily got pushed out of mainstream respectable politics, but they certainly stopped publicly sharing that view. And I definitely think that this could be one of those moments where we look back and say, this was a turning point. You're seeing it. Tons of celebrities. You're seeing just absolute major backlash for politicians when they mess up. I don't know, for to dip into the U.S., but the favorite to be the next mayor of New York, Andrew Yang,
oh my God,
got absolutely, and rightfully so, yeah, absolutely obliterated on Twitter. Yeah, horrific what he said. You know, he basically took Israel's side 100%, kind of like an O'Toole level vileness in his statement. And absolutely got hammered and then got disinvited from a Muslim community he was supposed to visit. AOC wrecked him. Biden's been heavily criticized by progressives for his statement, which again basically amounts to we want peace, but Israel has a right to defend itself. I do think that, you know, we are entering a period where, at the very least, criticism of Israel with regard to Palestine is going to become much more common, and is now, I think, it contested still, but now going to be part of like respectable mainstream political discourse. And I think that's crucial, because before, until very recently, it was almost political suicide to criticize Israel on this regard, or even just to be in any way not specifically anti-Palestine.
Yeah, you we have saw to be it, pro-Israel. Earlier this year when we had Nikki Ashton on, because Jeremy Corbyn was anti-Semitic, yeah. And just, which is just that notion bled bullshit, three man. Levels over to Nikki Ashton talking to him in Canada. Yeah. So it's just, it's insane, right?
So like I'm under no illusion that that's going to fully go away, but I am now convinced that more and more people are seeing the truth that it's a genocide and that only Israel can stop it.
Well, I just wanted to now go to our Patreon pool. We had a couple of questions. And again, if you do have a couple of bucks, please join us. Patreon.com/LeftTurnCanada. Getting some lively discourse now. Really great to connect with, you know, a lot of people that are just working in the community and are telling us what it's like to actually have real jobs, that are faced with these, you know, real COVID pains of what's going on. But there was one question from Kurt, the Patreon supporter, that asked, how is it that Israel has this much influence over every talking point, basically within the entire Western political class? So if you will, Crystal, I'm going to take a stab at this, and in classic left turn fashion, I'm going to say something and you'll come in with the nuance to make sure it's correct. So I'm glad we got
that. Well, I wouldn't put it that way.
That's what I'm putting it. See, you even came in now to make sure it was right what I just said. But so basically, and this is by no means, you know, this is a big issue that goes back very, very far. But my understanding is that in 1965, Israel became a real linchpin for the imperialist Middle Eastern foreign policy of the United States. They were fighting against Sovietism in the region, against the Arab bloc, and America kind of became, at that point, their own self-appointed peace broker, allowing them to have this feeling of autonomy within the region and kind of always have a voice in these conflicts. And if you fast forward from there to a couple more decades, as the Cold War is dwindling, this ultra-Zionist sentiment is beginning to rise in the United States. It's mirrored by a lot of the evangelical movement within this region. And into the 80s and 90s, the fear of the rise of terrorism really pushes the notion that the United States has to be involved in this region to now protect not only Israel, but their own people. And I think that really gave way to justify the full force of America's military-industrial complex, which is such an essential economic drive for the United States since World War II. It's really, I don't even know if they've really adopted or changed from that model in these trying times. And it just became kind of like this ability for them to have a staging ground to keep pushing these economic forces. And when you couple that with a growing sentiment of familiarity, a religious understanding of the necessity to protect this holy land by constituents, coupling that with, you know, now U.S. capitalists being able to siphon off these freelance intelligence agencies in the Harvey Weinstein case to hide the fact they're raping people. Like, it's this horrible idea of symbiosis that seems to work together with this full force of economic push. So I just think that it's something that, like we talk about a lot here, if you can push to break it, I don't think it's something that we will look for again. I think it was something that was created to push these ideals. And here in Canada, we're just kind of following those same economic forces that America was going through, those same sort of paths culturally and economically. But we need to push against the idea that it's the only democracy in the region. Like, hasn't Netanyahu had like 5 re-elections in the last year that if he doesn't win, he's going to jail or something like that? Like, it just,
part of that is based on the Israeli system. I mean, the Israeli system, they have a proportional system, which I generally support, but it does lead potentially to the inability to form a government. And you need to be able to, under the Israeli system, to form an kind of functioning government. They don't really have a quote unquote minority parliament system. But I mean, I think that's correct. I think that there's a lot to be said for how Israel is a settler colonial project. And if you look at the countries that dominated, at least the non-Soviet countries after World War II, those countries or their descendants, their national descendants, played a major role. And whether we're talking about England or the United States or Canada or New Zealand or countries like France that don't have the same sort of settler colonial existence, but were definitely an imperialistic and colonialist country. These societies, were able to, in a way, build what is in many ways a little piece of Europe in the Middle East.
Yeah.
I mean, Israel is in a lot of ways a form of European colonialism. It is a settler colonial state in what is the land of the Palestinian people. Mm-hmm. And this is not to say, again, like, you can't make 100% direct equivalencies between Israel and Canada, but you can make a heck of a lot of equivalencies. And I do think there is something to be said for the fact that, hey, you know, at the end of the day, Israel exists in that way. There's a great clip of Biden. I don't think we're going to play it here because we don't want to go too in the weeds, but it was a clip of Biden back when he was in the Senate, I believe in the 90s, saying that, you know, we should not only defend our alliance with Israel, but we should celebrate it and proclaim it. It is the best $3 billion we spend a year, or whatever the number was he mentioned. The best investment the United States makes. There's no better investment. In fact, if Israel didn't exist in the Middle East, we would have to create an Israel to protect our interests.
Oh my God.
So the United States see, at least that's Joe Biden, who I think represents a fairly establishment point of view. One of Biden's greatest strengths is being a political weather vane, sort of knowing where the consensus is in neoliberal corporate politics. And he, I think, reflected that value that Israel is in some ways an essential element of the American project. There are other factors, of course, too. The United States has other allies in the region that exist to kind of, for whether for resource purposes or whether to undercut other forces. For instance, you know, the U.S. used to have an alliance with a certain man named Osama bin Laden, at least to some degree, to undercut Soviet influence. And in many ways, both Israel and Saudi Arabia, two countries with we might call a checkered record on human rights within and beyond their borders, are essential U.S. allies, in part because they are seen as countervailing forces to Iran, right?
Yeah, and I think isn't there a big push as well to establish more firm ally ties between them independently as well, which kind of goes against.
I mean, I'm not an expert.
Project, right?
But it is a controversial thing because in certain elements of Saudi Arabia, they have Muslim fundamentalists who do not like Israel, but then you have a more pragmatic sort of state that is still Islamic in a sense, but sees Islamic provisions as a tool to further state power rather than as value in and of themselves. But I'm not an expert on Israel's relationship with Saudi Arabia. But the point is, like, one of the reasons is, at the end of the day, countries like Canada and the United States see Israel as the closest thing to being a Western nation in the Levant, in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And I think it also has something to do with, historically, there was a lot of the in terms of waves of immigration, there were larger levels of Jewish immigration to Canada and the United States before there was large levels of Muslim immigration. It may be the case that people have a greater familiarity with Jewish people than they do with Arabic people. In the post 9/11 era, there's just been a general form of Islamophobia, which in many ways has intensified. And while anti-Semitism is in no way gone, and if anything is on the rise as well, there is a sense there. And with the United States in particular, we can't discount the role of fundamentalist Christianity.
Yeah.
There is a sense that Israel is part of the prophecy for certain interpretations of Christian eschatology about how, like, the world is going to end and all that. And one of the arguments is that until Israel has firm control over the entire Holy Land, as defined, you know, by the Bible, then the end times won't happen. And so there's a sense that Christians have to support a strong Jewish Israel because that's the only way to fulfill Christ's return. That's
and they not do as well. It's not just a belief. Like, there are thousands of evangelicals every year that go.
And there's a lot of money. They raise money to make this happen. And it's a tactical alliance because these people still ultimately believe that if you don't accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, you will burn for all eternity. And that includes Jewish people who do not necessarily religiously Jewish people. who do not necessarily accept that, right? So, but, like, and another example here, and this is from a friend of the show, Andre Demise, who's a brilliant writer and academic and commentator. he made a good point saying that, you know, at least historically, people like Theodor Herzl, who was a precursor of the Jewish state, he passed away before Israel was formed. But his argument was seen as foundational from a philosophical perspective to form it. And he would repeatedly make the argument in the 18 and 1900s that Israel would exist as a piece of Europe in Asia. He would be quoted as saying, "We should there form a portion of a rampart of Europe against Asia, an outpost of civilization as opposed to barbarism." And so he notes basically that the Jewish state is a and he would often use this to persuade European leaders to support the formation of a Jewish state, to say this would create a buffer in a way between Europe and the barbarous people of the Middle East and further eastward. Now, that might not be the only reason, of course, but I definitely think that's part of it. And you know, I think those are the major factors. It's mutual interest. Islamophobia, I think, is more dominant in at least in geopolitical policy than anti-Semitism right now.
Oh yeah.
If not necessarily on a individual basis, everywhere. And I definitely think that there's this philosophical view that Israel is part of like the European colonial project, even if that is rarely admitted.
Yeah, and you know, we saw these connections here. We talked about them this week, and I guess I just want to end off here, Christo, with this idea of change. You know, you mentioned it before that the real way to make change here is for Israel to stop doing what they're doing. Will we see, you said in 30, 40 years, maybe it'll be seen similar to apartheid South Africa, but are there things now that people who are affected by, you know, this atrocity can do to, you know, try to make this just a little bit better for the people that are fighting for their lives to protect their homes?
Well, I think like we were both talking about this. I definitely think that you can support groups, you can support charities that are trying to make this happen through various means. So I know, Andy, you have one, but I wanted to talk a bit about a Canadian group that's the Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East that have been a consistent, you know, progressive view ally on, you know, building a Middle East where everyone can live in dignity and security. And one of their main focuses, it's not their only focus, of course, is justice for Palestinians. And I think that that's crucial if we want to get it done. And I think that in Canada, we have to have a balance of supporting efforts in Palestine itself, but realize that, you know, if we're going to get stuff done, we need to put pressure on our own government, because the Canadian state is one of the forces that helps to legitimize what Israel does. Because again, Israel knows, and the individual people that do this, like the individual people stealing homes, know that they have the backing of countries like Canada and the United States. And so long as they do, they can act with impunity. And the military of those countries, they think the same thing. And the politicians, the same thing. And so we need to make a change here in Canada. And it's likely the best thing we can do.
And there
so
you go.
If you want, yeah, maybe we'll put a link. Just certainly check them out, because they have a ton of good resources and whatnot. But you can also consider donating to CJPME.
So this week, if you were going to give us a fiver, you know, give it to these organizations. Because the next one that is a big one that's helping right now is the Islamic Relief of Canada Palestinian Emergency Fund. So this is money that's going directly to, thanks to these networks that have been in place for so long to help the Palestinians in this region, going directly to the people that are being killed by their families, rather, and are being maimed by a lot of these airstrikes and the IDF military incursion. So this is a way you can directly give money to help those who are hurting right now. They also do a lot of other outreach in the region of that whole area of Yemen emergency funds. And it's really a great little way to help if you can. And like Christo said, make those pushes happen. We're seeing the conversation change a little bit. You know, there is a tinge of hope here that it's not as extreme for those that speak out against it as it was even a few years ago. But this momentum needs to be pushed, and we need to push these politicians to do better. And this week, like you said, Christo, Yagmeet did pretty well, but there's still movement here, and you can still ask for more, because, you know, it's I would say it's a little cliche, but it seems to be really the right thing to do. So is there anything else, Christo, before we end this kind of dreary episode?
No, I mean, look, we all got to stay strong. This is one of those issues where, you know, this when you want to know, like, which side are people on? This is one of those issues. All of us that stand for justice for Palestine need to stick together. And we're not going to stop talking about this issue. You know, this is crucial. You know, often people say foreign policy is a foreign policy, but like, you know, we can't build a just Canada if there's injustice beyond our borders. Justice for everyone or justice for no one.
If you like today's show, consider joining the Harbinger Media Network. which include shows like Alberta Advantage and the 49th Parallel. For access to these programs and more, go to theharbingermedianetwork.com.